When you're writing a work of fiction, how could you go wrong when your setting is Hackensack and your main character's name is Constance Cupp? Well, such is the case with the book Girl Waits with a Gun, the latest offering from Amy Stewart, a prolific author from our neck of the woods. The book is a departure from the previous works in that it's fiction, but it's historical fiction based on real people and real events. Amy Stewart is a repeat visitor to the Exchange, not just because she lives in Eureka and owns a bookstore there, but because the books she writes are fun. She taught us about the weed that killed Lincoln's mother in Wicked Plants and about growing cocktail ingredients in The Drunken Botanist. Girl Waits with a Gun is Amy's seventh book. Amy Stewart, welcome back to the Exchange.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back.
Always good to have you. So this is about real people, but called a novel. How did that all work out?
Well, I ran across this story in the New York Times archives from 1915. I was actually doing research for The Drunken Botanist. I was going to write about a gin smuggler named Henry Kaufman. And I just wanted to, you know, see if he had done anything else interesting. So I went searching for him, and I turned up a story about another guy named Henry Kaufman. I never could figure out if they were the same person. But this Henry Kaufman ran his automobile into a horse and buggy being driven by these three sisters and destroyed their buggy, and they got into a fight over the damages, and it just turned into this crazy conflict that went on for a year, and it was a pretty remarkable story, so I was kind of hooked right from that first newspaper clipping.
Huh, that was one of those things you just grabbed in the way of putting the Drunken Botanist together and said, I got to get back to this later?
Exactly. That's exactly what happened, yeah.
Huh. So now usually it's the names that are changed in fictionalized accounts, but the names of these characters are all real?
Yeah, I wanted to keep everything that actually happened the way it was. So the names are unchanged, the major details about their lives are unchanged, and if something really happened to them, it's in the book. I put a little note at the end that explains what's fiction and what's not, but basically I just used fiction to fill in the gaps where I couldn't possibly know what happened. Like, I don't know what they talked about at home, you know, and I don't know some of the motivations for why people did what they did. But I was so fascinated by the true story that I didn't see much of a reason to change it.
And how much were you able to find out? I mean, did they keep diaries, write letters to each other, do any of the things that are usual sources of information for the characters of people you were trying to research?
Yeah, I wish. I would give anything for a diary. What I have are newspaper clippings. You know, here's the thing. When these three sisters got into a fight with Henry Kaufman over the damages to their buggy, the conflict escalated until pretty soon Kaufman was firing shots at their house and throwing bricks through the window and sending kidnapping threats. They were really under siege. It was kind of like they picked the wrong guy to get run into by, you know. So the newspapers covered this quite a bit. I mean, it was a pretty sensational crime. And the most remarkable thing that happened kind of early on is that the sheriff issued all three of them revolvers so that they could defend themselves. They lived alone out in the countryside. And so Girl Waits with Gun, you know, that title was a newspaper headline about the oldest sister, Constance, standing on a street corner with a gun in her handbag trying to catch this guy. So most of what I had to go on was not letters and diaries, but newspaper clippings and some things I dug out of courthouse records and other more publicly available records like that.
You know, just on some of the basic facts, these are interesting people to begin with. I mean, Constance Cupp, now there's a great name for a deputy. How physically imposing was she?
She was, in real life, she was about 6 feet tall, weighed 180 pounds. So, you know, she would have towered over most men at that time. If you've ever seen maybe a documentary about World War I or even gone to a museum and seen the uniforms that soldiers wore, they were little. People were smaller. So she would have been kind of an imposing presence, even for these thugs going after her.
Right. And so there are three cop sisters in all, Constance, Norma, and Florette. And mm-hmm. you found them pretty amusing from the get-go, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I love the idea of three sisters, and rarely do you read anything about sisters doing anything at all together as adults. You know, I mean, sisters are forced to live together when they're kids, but Constance was 35 and Norma was about 31. The youngest sister, Florette, was still a teenager. But, you know, I was intrigued by the idea of these three personalities. In real life, they were all three very different from one another. I was able to do some interviews with family members and get a sense of who, what their personalities were. And I just thought these would be such fun characters to write.
So what were you able to find out about things like family history and income and just basic details like that?
Well, you know, I used Ancestry.com to do their genealogy. So I had census records. I had directory listings that showed me where they lived. I was able to get birth certificates and property records, you know, and things like that. So I traced their family back pretty far. These three sisters grew up in Brooklyn and moved out to New Jersey later, and I was able to trace them back to their parents' immigration in the mid-1800s into the United States. So I knew that they were they had been somewhat well provided for. They were reasonably middle class. They owned some land, but we're talking about three women who are unmarried and have no jobs and no way to support themselves. So their funds were dwindling, and they were probably starting to feel some pressure. So it is amazing how much of those kind of details, like income and what kind of house they lived in and where, you can dig up out of public records. It was kind of a little treasure hunt, and I really found a lot.
You've committed the journalist's dream here, having the time to be able to look into this stuff. But
exactly.
even then, as you point out, Amy Stewart, not a lot of information about some of the specifics of the case or the people. We'll come back and talk more about Girl Waits with Gun, Amy Stewart's latest book, a fictionalized account of some real people and real events in northern New Jersey a century ago. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Amy Stewart and your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today was once again Amy Stewart, Eureka bookstore owner and author. Her latest book is a novel based on real people and real circumstances in northern New Jersey a century ago, where some sisters who were getting terrified by a wealthy and rather nasty man decided to defend themselves and, with the help of the sheriff, got guns. The book is called Girl Waits with a Gun. It is about the cop sisters. No joke there. Join us on the Exchange if you have comments or questions. 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about the fact that the parents left some money to the cop sisters. They had some land, but their funds were dwindling. How unusual was it a century ago for three grown sisters to be living together with, if we'll all pardon the expression, no man around?
Right. Yeah, that's the thing that kind of interested me so much about this. You know, 100 years ago, women didn't have the vote. We didn't really have the ability to fully participate in civic affairs. It would have been very hard to get bank accounts, do financial transactions, run a business. You know, some people listening might remember that in the 60s and even into the early 70s, women couldn't get credit cards and bank accounts in their own names. You know, you go into the bank to get a credit card or apply for a business loan or something like that, and they'd say, well, this looks very nice, and as soon as your husband comes in and signs the paperwork, we'll get this going for you. You know, that's pretty recent. So 100 years ago, it was very unusual for women to be off by themselves trying to figure out how to run their own lives. It would have been much more common for the three of them to move in with their older brother, which he kept offering to do and almost insisting that they do, or to even live with an uncle or some other male relation if they couldn't be at home with their parents. And in this case, their mother had died and their father was not in the picture.
Here's where you get a chance in fiction to come up with some interesting situations. But Francis does offer to have the girls move in with him, the women move in with him. How sincere is he the way you write him, though?
Well, you know, the way I write Francis is that he's a good guy for his era. He's trying to do the right thing, and he doesn't really spend a lot of time wondering about whether he should or not. He's doing what's expected of him, which means taking in these sisters. And he has to figure out a way for that to work with his household. So he's always trying to figure out things they could do. Well, you could tutor the children. You could help with the housework. Florette, the youngest sister, is and was in real life a very talented seamstress. So, well, maybe you could take in some sewing. You know, he's always, and all of this just sounds horrible to these three sisters. They can't stand the idea. So they're really trying very hard to figure out a way to manage on their own. But when they get attacked by Henry Kaufman, you know, their brother sort of thinks, well, this is exactly what I was afraid was going to happen. You three are sitting ducks out here, and something's got to be done.
You know, you mentioned the different attitudes of the time between the genders, certainly. And I wonder, given the fact that that newspapers tended to be a little more judgmental in some of their copywriting at that time, if some of their life circumstances were commented upon and the stuff you were digging up from the New York Times and other papers of the period, if there were some snotty references made to them being these spinsters living alone or something.
Oh, all the time. Yeah. Anytime a woman did anything at all unusual, newspapers jumped on it. They just thought it was hilarious. You know, they thought that lady police officers, they would call them lady policemen. they thought lady policemen were hilarious. Women athletes. There was a very funny article in the newspaper right around that time in 1914 about two women who were going to go run a foot race. And just the idea that a couple of women were going to go outside and run was seen as absurd. And, you know, a crowd was going to gather to watch this weird spectacle. So, yeah, newspapers, I mean, you know, they were trying to sell papers. And so they were trying to be sensationalist. And so they drew very funny drawings. I have some of them on my website. Very funny drawings of these three women with their guns in their hands. And it was very much a caricature. You know, they were making fun of them.
Oh, the picture of the three sisters all with their guns raised and ready to fire is a pretty funny picture.
It is.
We're talking to Amy Stewart about her latest book, Girl Waits with Gun. It's a novel, but based on real people. Amy, of course, from Eureka, where she owns a bookstore. You mentioned you did find some family members. What kinds of gaps were they able to fill in for you?
Well, they were really helpful. The first person I found was their brother's grandson, and he lives in Pennsylvania. He's in his 60s. He didn't know them, but he heard a lot of stories about them. One interesting thing that I heard from his side of the family is that Francis's little daughter, so this would have been their niece, was terrified of her Aunt Constance, very intimidated by her. And I found that so interesting. Like, what kind of woman would intimidate and terrify a sweet little girl in the 1910s, 1920s era? And that's how I really wanted to write Constance. I don't think Constance quite realized how frightening or intimidating she might be, but she was very plain-spoken, said exactly what was on her mind, and also just her sheer size and kind of her willpower and determined attitude probably would have seemed very strange to a little girl who was trying to figure out how girls behave and how to be good, because I don't think Constance thought much about how to be good.
You did choose to write the book in first person from Constance's point of view. It's an interesting choice. How'd you arrive at that?
You know, I felt that I wanted the story to be told in her voice. I thought that if I wrote it in third person, it would be told in my voice. I thought I would have a harder time getting my 21st century voice out of the way. You know, I've written six books that are all told in my voice. The first three are actually written in first person. And the next three, even though they're not written in first person, that's me talking. And I didn't know how I could break that habit. I was very interested in the language of the era of the 1910s. You know, I've read a ton of novels written in the 1910s, and of course all those newspaper articles, and the language is, you know, we're just at the end of the Victorian era, so there's sort of a little bit of this Baroque Victorian aspect to how they talked. But then we're about to enter into the very beginning of modernity, so we're almost getting into the era of noir, you know, and kind of this more punchy rat-a-tat-tat modern way of speaking. And I wanted to do that. And also, I just love Constance, and I very much identify with her, and I felt very close to her, and I wanted her to speak for herself.
Give us a bit then, Amy, about the setting for the book. This is northern New Jersey a century ago.
Yeah. It's an interesting time and place. You know, Paterson, New Jersey was a town dominated by the silk industry. So it was a factory town. And Henry Kaufman, their sort of their enemy, their attacker, he owned a silk factory. So he definitely represented the powerful elite of Paterson, New Jersey. It was, as you can imagine, pretty corrupt. The city council and the police and the justice system was all in the pocket of the factory owners. And there was a lot of unrest. The Paterson Silk Strikes of 1913 had happened just the year before, and this was a huge moment in the American labor movement. Tens of thousands of workers out on strike, rioting in the streets. So it was a lot of unrest and a lot of turmoil in those days.
And then the major event in the book, the touch-off point that brings the characters into contact with each other is Henry Kaufman running his car into the horse and buggy of the cop sisters. I'm a little surprised that Henry Kaufman would have been driving the car himself, but he was.
Yeah, well, you know, in those days, cars were still kind of a toy. They were pretty novel. There were lots of people in 1914 who thought, oh, this car thing isn't going to last forever. we don't need to worry about you know, because the roads weren't made to accommodate cars, and everyone was trying to figure out, are we going to have to build new roads? And people would say, nah, don't worry, this is all flash in the pan. But even wealthy and powerful people would have driven their own cars because it was so much fun. It was something people really wanted to do. So, yeah, you know, the fact that it's a car crash, really, it's interesting because it does sort of represent, you know, the end of the Victorian era and the beginning of the modern era, this collision between a horse and buggy and a car.
And the beginning of road rage, too.
No kidding, yeah.
Girl Waits with Gun is the latest book by Amy Stewart, who is from Eureka. She owns a bookstore there in addition to writing now 7 books. It is a novel based on real people in real places and real circumstances of a century ago. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like with questions or comments for Amy, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. This is so early in the days of cars. What did you find out about procedures and protocols for reporting accidents and getting police help and establishing responsibility, and even insurance, I guess, would probably enter into it or not at that time?
Yeah, no insurance. There was almost none of all the things you just rattled off. That's what was so interesting. You know, law enforcement at that time was still pretty ad hoc. The constables and deputy sheriffs working in that part of New Jersey at the time were mostly volunteers who'd received very little training. There were not mechanisms for really reporting crimes. There was no calling 911. There was nothing like that. They weren't really set up to receive complaints and process them the way police are today. And there were no rules about what to do in terms of taking reports and stuff like that. So when this wreck occurred, Constance did the natural thing, which is just to say, well, you know, pay up, send an invoice. Those kinds of disputes tended to get worked out between people as individuals. And when she first went to the county prosecutor's office for help, he refused to help her. And this is all true. This is exactly how it happened. He basically said, well, don't you have a father or a brother or someone who can work this out? Why are you here? And it wasn't until the sheriff got involved that they actually finally managed to get some help with this situation.
Do you think Kaufman's response to handling the situation, and of course this can only be conjecture, but you can also tell us how you wrote it in the fictionalized account. But I mean, was his contempt based for just a general contempt for anybody, or more because it was it's just women I ran into with my car?
Yeah, well, that was one of my biggest questions, and one of the reasons I wanted to write it as fiction is that I didn't have an answer to the question of why did he go after them the way they did. So in my telling of it, he's a bad seed. He's the son of a wealthy factory owner, comes from a big family with a lot of money, but he's just a bad guy, you know. He's a drunk. He likes to drive around in his fast car and smoke cigars and gamble, and he's got sort of a rough crowd that he runs around with. And he does not want to run his daddy's factory, and he's kind of running the business into the ground and spending money as fast as he can. So, you know, he's just a bad guy to begin with, but he definitely doesn't want to be pushed around by a woman. And Constance, in a way, didn't know her own strength. You know, she wasn't used to being out in public and dealing with people. They'd been very secluded on their farm in New Jersey. So she went after him pretty aggressively, humiliated him in front of his friends. And I think that the I think there kind of was a certain amount of vitriol and hatred directed at women who stepped too far out of bounds. So I think that's what some of that was.
Let me tie a couple of other threads together here, because you mentioned Henry Coffin's general circumstances. We talked about the labor circumstances in Patterson just a year before, in 1913. What was Coffin's view of his own workers and his own? This is a silk mill, right?
Yeah, this was a silk mill. He was actually a silk dyer, so he would get the raw silk and it would be dipped into vats of dye and sold off by the pound. You know, and ironically, they used to add things to the dye to make the silk heavier, since they were selling it by the pound, so they could get more money, and then it would kind of flake off when you were wearing the silk. Very cheap, gross stuff.
Oh, yikes. Was it things like lead, too?
Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. No, that was it. So, Henry Coffman didn't have much of a view of the workers. He was an owner only in name only, and probably had a foreman who was trying to run the factory, but Coffman was a very negligent and uninterested factory owner. And, you know, factory workers had a real tough time at that time. The reason that they had gone out on strike the year before is that the factories wanted them to work longer hours and to operate four machines at a time instead of two, which would have made the factory owners much more wealthy, would have brought in a lot more profit for them, but they weren't going to pay the workers any more to do it. And the workers weren't stupid. They figured out that if they were the ones bringing in all the profit, that they should get a share of it, and that's why they went out on strike.
And there's a reference to the children's evacuation in Patterson. What was that?
Well, yeah, this was a very interesting little sort of footnote in this story, which is that during these strikes, all of which happened right before the book started, the factory workers couldn't afford to feed their kids. They were out of work for 6 months, and the union set up relief tents so they could go out and get some food, but the tents ran out of food every day. So some of the factory workers had no choice but to send their children into New York City to live with family members who were sympathetic to the union cause and would feed them and take care of them until everybody was back to work and they could afford to go home. And I have these heartbreaking photographs of these little children with little notes pinned to their coats getting ready to get on a train and go into New York to live with complete strangers. And so one of the things that I found out is that there were a few kids who never came back. And that really interested me, and I thought it gave me an idea for kind of a way to create a fictional character who's been through something like that, who works in Henry Kaufman's factory, that Constance gets involved with. So it sort of gave me a way into that story of the silk strikes and the children's evacuation.
This is Lucy Blake?
Yes, Lucy Blake was her name.
All right, interesting character. We're talking about the book Girl Waits with Gun, the latest work from Amy Stewart, who's a Eureka author and bookstore owner here on the Jefferson Exchange. So so Henry Coffman runs his car into the cop sister's horse and buggy, busts the buggy up badly enough that it can't be used again. She sends Henry a bill for $50 to repair the horse carriage, and it sounds like a lot of money for that day, was it?
It was a lot of money. They were living on about $1,000 a year at that time. For kind of a regular working stiff, $50 probably would have been about 2 weeks' salary. And it was more or less the cost of a brand new buggy. So, you know, if you think about if your car got ruined and that was your way of transportation and you needed a new car, that's what that $50 meant to them.
So she sends invoices twice, no reply twice. Readers really get some tension as Constance prepares to confront Coffman at his factory. Is there any record of a true meeting between them?
Yeah, that's one thing I really don't know. I don't know how often they crossed paths. And, you know, one of the challenges for me as a writer, since I'm telling this from Constance's point of view, that is limiting because it means that nothing can happen unless Constance is there to see it or someone tells her about it. So I had them butt heads and confront one another several times in the book, mostly so I had a way of getting them in the same room together so I could write about them. They did. I know they appeared in court together because I have a copy of the indictment, But that's everything else about that is fictional, but based on newspaper accounts that suggest that something along those lines must have happened at some point.
You know, the steam and the smells and the colors and just the general setting of the factory is so vivid. I mean, does this factory still even exist? I know you did spend some time there.
I went to Patterson. I had the address of the factory. And where the factory was is a vacant lot now. But right next door to it is a silk dyeing factory. So maybe that was his factory, and, you know, street addresses can change. Or maybe it was just the one right next door that probably looked very similar to his. So, yeah, the scenes that I wrote in and around the factory are based on a real place that I was able to go and see. And, you know, that was kind of the most amazing thing about this, was getting to imagine all these places from my attic in Eureka and then get on a plane and actually go see them and look at them myself.
That does sound like a lot of fun. That's the research for Girl Waits with Gun, Amy Stewart's latest book, a novel based on real people and real circumstances in northern New Jersey a century ago. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Amy Stewart and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Eureka author and bookstore owner, Amy Stewart. She's written a new book, a novel, about some real people and real circumstances in northern New Jersey more than a century ago. The book is called Girl Waits with Gun, about Constance Kopp, yes, her real name, and her sisters, and the circumstances, the altercation with a silk factory owner who ended up running into their horse and buggy and ended up terrorizing them in some cases. They ended up packing guns. Girl Waits with Gun, the book. Amy Stewart, our guest. You can join in the conversation, 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Patterson, I want to come back to the industrial surroundings of Patterson, because very industrial town, but really significant in the American Industrial Revolution overall. And you do provide some of that background in the book. Explain a little bit there, would you, Amy?
Well, you know, Alexander Hamilton had this idea that Patterson ought to be America's first corporate city, industrial city. He imagined a city that was run by a board of directors, not elected officials, and shareholders and all of that. And that didn't exactly come to pass in the way that he thought it might. But in fact, Patterson is a town where locomotives were built. Colt, speaking of guns, Colt was started in Patterson, and then all these silk factories powered by the Great Falls. That was one of the things, is that they had water for power, and of course, very easy train access in and out of New York. So it was a very industrial city, and workers who lived there were in a lot of ways living in a company town. It was really hard to get away from the influence of your employer. You know, when the Patterson silk strikes happened, the factory owners went around all the bakeries in town and said, don't sell food to the strikers. So there was, you know, only one or two bakeries who dared go against them and actually bake bread for the workers.
Wow, it sounds almost like the mob.
Totally. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So obviously when Constance goes to the police and says, I've got this problem with Henry Kaufman, the police in Patterson say, forget it, we're out of our depth here. I mean, you don't know what they were told directly, because those conversations are lost to history. But was there any filing of reports or anything you could find with the police right there in Patterson?
No, not with the, well, yes, actually, I take that back. Henry Kaufman was fined $5 for the accident. And so that actually did happen. That was sort of like a little civil matter that did happen early on in Patterson. But this thing quickly escalated from a civil matter to a criminal matter. And most of the crimes were occurring out in their farmhouse the next county over. And that's really why the sheriff stepped up and got involved, is that all of a sudden we've got letters, extortion letters being sent through the mail. You know, Henry Kaufman at one point wrote a letter saying, pay us $1,000 or we're going to kidnap your youngest sister and burn down your house. And so that's when they were really able to get some law enforcement help.
And by this point, too, the letters are not just being sent through the mail. Sometimes they're on notes crashing on through windows on bricks.
Right.
Did that really happen?
I don't know for sure how every single letter was sent. I do know that it was a big deal when some arrived through the mail, because then they were able to get the postmaster involved and look at it as a bigger extortion crime with the use of the mails, making it kind of a higher level, higher priority crime that they could go after.
All right, so here we get jurisdiction overlaps or
exactly.
separations too, particularly
right.
when she goes to the local sheriff, and this is in Bergen County, New Jersey, right?
Uh-huh.
And so what he does actually respond, though, not in the pocket of the mill owners there, I gather.
Right, yeah. You know, the great thing about Sheriff Heath, he's someone I actually know quite a bit about. I have the transcript of speeches that he made at conferences. And he was in the newspapers every day, so it's easy to know about Sheriff Heath. And what I know about him is that he was really a good guy. He was a reformer. He was very progressive. He believed in getting at the root causes of poverty and crime, so he was always trying to do things to rehabilitate prisoners rather than just lock them up. Obviously, he saw something in Constance and enlisted her help with this investigation, which was incredibly unusual for a man of his time. So he was the kind of guy who would have stood up against the factory owners and stood up against the establishment. And he took a lot of heat from it. He was under constant criticism for his ideas about just about everything. It's not easy to go up against those guys.
No doubt. And he still managed to it's an elected position even there, right?
That's right.
Okay,
yeah.
So he kept getting elected. So I'm going to skip around a bit here, but Constance did become a deputy sheriff?
Yes, well, right. So that's kind of what's coming next. You know, there are going to be more books about the Cop Sisters. I've got an incredible amount of information about everything that happened in their lives as a result of this car accident. And it's going to take me a few books to tell. So we are going to get into the next thing that Constance got propelled into as a result of that. And that's coming very soon, actually.
Oh, please tell me her title is Constable.
Well, it's not actually. They were a constable was under the jurisdiction of the police, but the newspapers called her whatever they wanted. So there were definitely, you know, constable cop type headlines.
Right, exactly what I was looking for. Yeah.
Right, right.
Was the deputy sheriff position a bit more honorary then than it is in our time?
Well, here's the thing. The state of New Jersey, while the events of the book are taking place, the state of New Jersey passed a law allowing women to be police officers, and this was brand new. Up until that time, women worked with the police, often in unpaid volunteer positions, to help with the women and children who came through the law enforcement system. So the idea was it wasn't really proper for a man to be handling a female prisoner or even a witness or a victim. So they were doing that work. But did they have a badge and a gun and handcuffs and arrest authority? That was really the dividing line. Like, could they actually put the handcuffs on someone and arrest them? And that was a very new idea that we were only just starting to see. So, you know, Constance goes on to really do a lot of things that were extraordinary, even for women in law enforcement at the time. She stood out.
So since there is material here for more books, I'm curious to know how long the story of the Cop Sisters or Constance herself stayed in the papers or came and went.
It came and went, exactly. She was national news for a few years there. Stories ran in California, stories ran in Oregon. I have newspaper clippings from all over the country. She was a very big deal at the time. And, you know, everyone's forgotten about her. I mean, there's been nothing written about her, no books, no articles. There's not a Wikipedia page. There's nothing. So, she was a very big deal. And then as time goes on, I continue to turn stuff up. You know, I'm still doing the research. I go out to New Jersey, I read microfilm, and I find something new every time I'm there about what they were up to.
You mentioned finding a vacant lot at the address of the silk mill in Patterson, but finding a silk mill next door. And I didn't hear, is that closed too?
Oh, yes. No, yeah. It's this old, abandoned, crumbling brick building that nobody's been in for decades, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you get a chance to get inside at all and see? I,
I would have loved to have busted in, but I couldn't figure out a way in. I may have to go back in the cover of night and try to figure out if I can sneak in.
I wasn't sure how secure it was. I didn't want to get you in trouble with the Patterson police. But what about some of the other locations there? I mean, what has become of? I can just imagine their farm is probably a subdivision by now.
That's exactly what their farm is now. It's a subdivision. Their house is no longer there. I wrote letters to everyone who lives on that street who had any kind of structure on their property that looked to me like it might be that old. And as far as I can tell, the people that I've heard back from, they don't think that it dates back to that era. But, you know, there's a scene in the book, where, and this really happened, where Florette went down to the creek and somebody fired at her. And because I know where they lived, I was able to go and stand in the creek where gangsters were trying to shoot at Florette. So it is amazing to get to go to all those locations. You know, I went to the street corner where the girl waited with the gun. And, so I actually have a little driving tour. You know, I can call it all up on my phone and take people from one place to the other where all of these events happened.
You mentioned that it was the research for The Drunken Botanist, I guess, that first led you across the story of Constance Kopp. I wonder if you kind of shepherded things through for a while and then finally got to some set of documents or something that made you go, okay, that's it, I'm going to do this book.
Yeah, you know, that actually did happen in a way. I was gathering newspaper clippings. I was finding what I could from this great distance from being on the West Coast. And then I hired a genealogist in New Jersey to dig a little deeper, somebody who knew exactly where to go to get the courthouse records and how to put it together. And she was amazing. So she started turning up more and more about their personal lives. And with her help, one of the things that I found was a family secret, which I will not reveal because it'd be a little bit of a spoiler. But
I was going to say, protect the back of the book as much as you need.
Right. It changed how I saw them and how I thought about them, and it made them very real, and it made me understand their family better, and that's when I thought, oh, this is just too good. I have to do this.
Can we get to a few things about what might have happened to Henry Kaufman later in his life? Was it as short and as brutish as we hope it was?
You know, Henry Kaufman's very hard to track down. There were so many people with that name.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a very common name in New Jersey at the time. I do know that in real life he was married, and his wife filed for divorce about a month before the events in this book took place. So that is one factual thing that I changed about him in my telling of it. He was never married. So where he went and what he did, I don't know. I mean, I was able to trace his wife. She stayed put, and they had a couple of kids, but the trail kind of went cold just because the name is so common. You know, one thing that's happening now that the book is out is that I am starting to hear from people who say, I think that could be one of my relatives. So I've heard from one person who thought her great-grandfather was Henry Kaufman. It looks like it's not, but you never know. I mean, I may yet turn up more about him.
So at this point, I mean, you mentioned being able to find like a great-grand nephew. Mm-hmm. of one of the women, but so have you talked to anybody up to this point about who were actually family members of the Kaufmans?
Yeah. Oh, of the Kaufmans? No. Mm-hmm. No, I haven't found any Kaufmans. The other person I found who's really significant is Florette's son. Florette was the youngest, mm-hmm. and she happened to have children later in life, and so she has there's a son who's 80 years old and living in New Jersey. So the most incredible part about all of this was getting to get on a plane and go sit with someone who knew Florette so well and even remembered his Aunt Norma, the middle sister, from when he was a little boy and she was an old woman. So everything about Norma's personality is actually real and comes from someone who knew her personally. He might be the only person in the world who knew the Kopp sisters, so I go see him every chance I get in case he has a new memory he wants to share with me.
No doubt. He didn't have much memory of Constance, though, it sounds like.
No, he didn't get to meet Constance, but he knew the other two.
So you mentioned there are details in the book about the, you know, and there's a couple things you have to do in a work of fiction to keep it interesting. I know, but for one thing, Norma keeps pigeons, which I've heard is not something that she really did in life or that you know of anyway. Interesting detail to add. Well, how'd you fall across that one?
Well, you know, I needed some way to humanize Norma. Norma's a tough woman. She, in real life, she was very judgmental, very quick to criticize, very blunt. She didn't really like people very much. She held grudges. So she was tough. And I know women like that. You know, I mean, I think we all have somebody in our family, maybe. We have that aunt. So I thought, well, how do I make her a little bit more human? And I thought about women like that I knew who maybe they didn't like people so much, but they loved their little dog. And I didn't want to give her a little dog, but I thought carrier pigeons would be very interesting because they were still in use at that time for communication. Doctors would issue a carrier pigeon to patients living out in the country so they could send a pigeon back to the doctor with a message if they needed more medication or if something changed. It was probably the earliest form of telemedicine was carrier pigeon.
Right, something through the airwaves, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. So I understand that you created a cocktail especially for this book to follow along with the last book, The Drunken Botanist.
I did, yeah. we're serving drinks on the book tour. With Drunken Botanist, we had a cocktail at almost all of my book tour events. And, you know, people totally show up if you promise them a drink. So with this one, all the events on the tour, most of the events on the tour, we're doing this cocktail that's based on a real cocktail of the 1910s that was called the Automobile. It was equal parts gin, scotch, and sweet vermouth.
And I noticed that one of the ads refers to it as a glass of gasoline with a nut in it.
Yeah, right. It was terrible. don't ever drink it. But I improved it quite a bit. I replaced the scotch with Applejack, which is a New Jersey spirit, and a little bit of jam and some champagne, and it's delicious.
All right. All kinds of fun, as always, with Amy Stewart. The latest book is called Girl Waits with Gun. It's a novel, but based on real people in New Jersey more than a century ago. Amy, always a pleasure. Take care of yourself.
Oh, thanks so much. Mm-hmm.